On this episode of the People Stack podcast, Rob and I interviewed April Wenzel. She is the founder of Compassionate Coding. So she helps individuals and organizations in tech bring more compassion to their coding, to the organizations, to their culture. So she's actually back on the podcast. I interviewed her in October 2018. So we figured about five years later was a good time to check in again. We talked about what compassion means. We really unpacked that to a deep level, including the meaning of suffering and how compassion relates to suffering. We talked about connection and how connection is even more important now in, you know, post-COVID, in a world where there's so many Zoom meetings. We talked about communicating across differences and how intuition is such an important piece of that. We talked about assertiveness and the difference between assertive and aggressive communication. We also talked about mindfulness and spirituality and how that plays a really important role for leaders like you. If you want to bring more compassion, if you want to help have your team perform better, you have to bring the compassion. You have to inspire that compassion. And in a piece of that is mindfulness and even spirituality if you want it to be. So we had a fun, multi-layered, valuable conversation, and I know that whether you're a seasoned technical leader who wants to use this information to inspire your team, to inspire your organization to be more compassionate and to perform better, and so that you can all have more fun, or whether you're more early career or want to move into coding or software, I know that you're going to be able to extract some really valuable distinctions and to-dos and action items from this conversation. So please enjoy. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right. So hello, April. April Wenzel is with us here today, and she is back. I interviewed her on the podcast way back in October 2018. She is the founder of Compassionate Coding, and Rob and I are really excited to talk with you today, April. It's so awesome to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Good to see you both.
Yeah. So let's dive right in. What do you do at Compassionate Coding? What's your mission?
So at Compassionate Coding, I teach emotional intelligence skills of all sorts to people in tech. So mostly engineers, because my background's in engineering, software engineering. So I may teach communication skills, leadership, mentorship, avoiding burnout, basically the human side of things, but how it applies in tech. So sometimes that involves actual code and how we write code in a compassionate way. And it also involves how we communicate about code. So it runs the gamut there.
Love it. And what kind of methods and product services are part of this? I'm assuming there's maybe training, boot camps, things like that.
Yeah, it's a lot of trainings. So I do team trainings at companies for the most part, before the pandemic, of course, it was mostly in person, because when you're talking about sensitive issues, it's really helps for everyone to be in the same room and feeling the energy. During the pandemic, I adapted and, you know, as we all did, and embraced the virtual environment. But for emotional intelligence stuff, I still personally prefer in person. So a lot of times when teams have offsites, that sort of thing, that's a good time for me to come in. And I'm also currently working on an online training for individuals. So there's sometimes people at companies where they can't bring in the training for whatever reasons. Maybe they don't have buy-in, et cetera, but individuals will be able to access it. So that's the other thing. And I also publish content online. Just a lot of times when I give a talk at a conference or something like that, I'll just put up free stuff online about it, just because a big part of this is just getting the word out and hoping to instill more compassion and spread some awareness and tips and all of that. So I see that as part of the work as well.
That's awesome. Oh, I love this. I'm so excited to dive in. I'm remembering some of our conversation from almost 5 years ago, and I definitely want to catch up and add even more layers to that. And because as I know, you know, April, and I know that our listeners know, there's going to be a lot of overlap in terms of what we do here at the People Stack and our mission and what your mission is. But before we kind of get into that, I'm just out of curiosity, it sounds like your major, like the major players in your business would be companies coming to you and saying, hey, can you come and do a training for us?
Yeah, that has been how it's worked. Yeah. And it's been really nice because I never have to do the hard sell. I put out content and I like to see it as like a beacon. Like I put out, you know, my thoughts and that sort of thing. And then the companies say, oh, we could use that. And then that could be helpful here. And so I really like that approach too, just from, I don't know how it makes me feel, right? Like, I don't want to be bugging people. I want like to just offer it up and see what happens.
I love it. I love it. That's the way the best marketing works. I think we feel that way about some of our marketing as well, where it's just, I'm attracting it. I'm the magnet, you know, we're putting this stuff out there and whoever wants to do it, once is attracted to it and feels that it's valuable, then they can contact you. I imagine there's a number of companies, right, especially right now, are wanting to look at the people or the human or the quote unquote soft side of things, which has very hard outcomes, which I know we're going to get into as well. So what would you say would be the top, I don't know, two or three or four overarching topics that companies either request that you talk about or that you find that there's a need to talk about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I, for each training, I didn't mention, but I do customize it. So basically I do sort of kind of like a user interview with the manager and people on the team to hear what's going on there. And then, create content that addresses those specific issues and interests and that kind of thing. But that said, there are some common themes that come out. I think a big one lately, not going to come as a surprise, is helping people feel connected and feel that sense of belonging in this virtual world, which again, the virtual world does help people, you know, help make it more inclusive in some ways, and that people can work remotely and sometimes that works better for people, but there are costs as well. So I think one thing we've been talking about a lot is how to bring that sense of belonging and bring that connection, especially when it comes to junior engineers. So a big issue that I've been seeing come out of companies is the senior people are super happy. They get to spend time with their family. They're off, you know, in these like great like houses that they've been able to get from their years in tech. And then the junior people come in and they're in like a tiny apartment and they live alone and they don't have experience and they're totally lost and they're afraid of bugging the senior people. And they're not doing great. And so that's just one example, but where there's kind of like competing interests and needs and that kind of thing. And I think finding balance in that and using compassion as a tool for seeing the different sides of these issues has definitely been a common one. I'll pause there just because I've been going on.
No, you're good. You're good. So connection, that totally makes sense that people are wanting to know how to connect more, especially in the virtual world with remote work and all of that. Are there one or two other themes that can tend to pop up a lot?
Yes. So I think especially, and this is related to the pandemic in some ways, but it's people coming, people having very different views on issues and still needing to work together. and so finding ways of communicating across difference has been another theme that's just, you know, always been around, but I feel like the events of the past few years have definitely made it a more common topic. So it's not uncommon for people to wonder how to approach sensitive issues or that sort of thing. And while it's not the main target of my work, of course, compassion helps in every way. And so finding strategies for having empathy, having compassion, even when people may disagree. And then a third one I would mention that has come out a lot during in So when I started my company, it was partly because I saw that there was a lot of that hard side and not really enough of the soft side. As I've gone on, I've realized that a lot of the companies that reach out to me lately have a lot of the soft side, but they actually need a little bit of the more tough side of compassion, which means like they need the assertive side of compassion. And so that's been something that's a little bit surprising too, is just that, you know, kind of maybe the pendulum is swinging a bit. And so people are kind of now afraid of approaching issues or bringing up things. And so I often am working on in the training, teaching strategies for bringing assertiveness and speaking up and that sort of thing and addressing that. So those are some of the ones, but again, it's what keeps it interesting for me is just that the issues vary so widely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rob?
So April, are you finding that basically the organizations that already know that compassion needs to be a part of their DNA are needing that assertive side? And are you also seeing more of the organizations that are well good on the harder assertive bit finally coming around to recognizing the role compassion needs to play?
I would say yes to both, in short. Definitely the first one, it's true. If people already understand compassion or already understand that it's important, already value it, let's say, I do think that they are more likely to be the ones saying, but we still need people to actually speak up and point out problems and that sort of thing. And so a lot of my talks recently have been on that. And I think too, maybe it's for good reason, like as in positive reasons, because people were so accommodating and kind during the pandemic. And so, you know, sometimes there's this fear of speaking up because they want to be understanding, but what people come to understand is that sometimes speaking up and giving direct feedback is how you are compassionate, and it's how you help someone grow, and it's how you help the team that, you know, function better. So that's true. And then I do think it's also true that people have softened a bit in some ways and opened their hearts a bit more to the idea of compassion, even if they were strongly against it in the past. And, you know, I think we saw this even before the pandemic. We started to see some of the prominent figures in tech that had previously been kind of the famous curmudgeons coming around. I won't call anyone out because it's not about that, but had started coming around and speaking about how, hey, you know, maybe there's something to this whole understanding emotions and treating people well sort of thing. And I think that the pandemic also helped open hearts in that way. Because, you know, sometimes if you haven't been through significant suffering in your life, or if at least you haven't been in touch with it, it's hard to understand why we need compassion in the first place, because why can't people just figure this out for themselves? It's not my job to, you know, fix people's problems. But then when you do go through some suffering, and some people went through some of the deepest suffering they've felt so far during the pandemic, I think it does help in that heart opening and just mind opening, if you want to think of it in that way too, to connecting and it helped people see what's important. And for all of those reasons, I do think, now that said, to make this more interesting, it's not so black and white. It's not so clear. There are definitely people also, some people's reaction to disaster and all that kind of thing is to kind of like protect themselves and keep everyone out. And so some people have built, you know, higher walls. And so there's also been that, and that's been interesting to contend with, especially online and social media, but it also on Teams. And so there's also that side. I'm not going to deny it. That's an issue as well. But those have been some of the trends that I've been seeing in, to answer your question.
Good. It's good to see both sides of it sort of coming to fruition. Something that we've noticed in our coaching, because we work predominantly with individuals, not organizations, mm-hmm. as sort of a primary thing. When you have an individual, each individual has this interesting blend of my experiences are unique and special and non-reproducible and not understandable to everyone. And also simultaneously, everybody goes through everything I'm just talking about, and it's and everybody's got the same valid opinions and everybody has the same experiences. When you're leading from the stage or you're leading from one of your engagements, how are you balancing between that internal monologue of everybody's had the same thoughts and experiences I have, and also I'm a special snowflake?
That's an interesting question. I mean, are they in conflict really? Because like, aren't they saying the same thing that like everybody has? I guess there's like some commonalities. Maybe that's the thing. And so maybe like the exact, I see what you're saying now. I think the exact nature of what we go through is going to always be different, right? The details of it are different. And I know that some people get really annoyed if you know, you say like, oh, I understand exactly what you're talking about, if you actually haven't been through it, because then it sort of makes them feel like, well, no, actually you don't know what I'm talking about because you haven't been through this particular experience. But that said, I think the key to uniting people and you know, building compassion and building bridges, especially across difference, is understanding that while we may not go through the exact same thing, we all go through something that hurts and we all go through something that feels good. And we all have certain common ground that helps us understand that though we may never experience the exact same thing, we can have some understanding of what it feels like to go through a tough time of some sort. And I do think that that's sort of how I address it, is that it's true that we all have our unique challenges. It's also true that we can find some similarities and some connections in across those differences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Before we get too far in, let's actually define compassion, because I'm imagining myself, here's my definition of how I feel like compassion is. And you've started to define it, April. And I know Rob has his, and then I'm imagining like all of the listeners, ooh, this is what compassion means. This is what compassion means. And so given that people can allow compassion to mean whatever it is that they want it to mean, whatever feels good to you, for you, and when you approach working with people, what's the most common way you might approach defining what we mean by compassion?
Yeah, so there's an interesting site. So Stanford has this Center for Altruism Research, and they have like a webpage where they have like, I don't know, 12 definitions or something like that. And that's only like a small sampling of the academic literature on, you know, defining compassion. So all that to say, like, and then like you said, individuals also have their own, but I think the original meaning is to suffer with, right? And so like calm is with and passion is suffer, right? So the original is like to suffer with. However, in the academic literature, I feel like it's evolved, and just in, you know, in culture, our society as well, it's evolved. And so how I like to think about this, and this comes from some of the papers on out there, especially some of the work at the Greater Good Science Center over at UC Berkeley, they define some of their stuff, they define compassion basically as the ability to understand suffering in people and the desire to alleviate it. So I sometimes simplify it myself to this idea of empathy plus action. So to make it very simple, but also probably to oversimplify, but basically it's not just understanding what someone's going through, but wanting to do something about it. So wanting to take some sort of action to help alleviate suffering. And again, this is not the only definition. And some people, you know, even define empathy in different ways, right? So it's like, this can get very complex, but then, you know, so I don't lose everybody, I try to keep it fairly simple when I'm first introducing it. But how about you? I'm curious to hear, you know, how you think about it, since you all also, you know, have thoughts on this topic.
I love it. I love it. We try to keep things as simple as possible here, while knowing that there's nuance, right? So that totally fits in with our messaging as well, in terms of, okay, if you want a simple definition, here's what it is. It's suffering with, it's understanding other people's suffering. And I really do love the empathy plus action, because action is so important. So then that brings up suffering. What is suffering? We actually talk about suffering quite a bit here at the People Stack. And one of the things that we often say is the suffering is optional. Because the way that we define suffering is that you can be emotionally regulated through the crisis. So whatever crisis might be happening, whether it's a global pandemic, or here we're on Maui, the fires of Lahaina just recently happened as of this recording. Yes, there's crisis, there's devastation. And through that, I can still rise. I can still be at peace. Where the suffering might be, to define it one way, I'm emotionally dysregulated. I'm allowing the fear, the anxiety, the disempowering emotions to take over me. I'm unconscious, as some people might call it. That's how we might define suffering. So do you define it similarly to that, or do you take a different approach to it?
I do. That does resonate with me. Absolutely. I think, it actually reminds me of this idea from Buddhism of like the two arrows. And so the first arrow is that hits you is like something bad happens or whatever. But the second arrow is kind of how you process it and how you, so the second arrow is kind of what you're talking about in terms of suffering, is that you can't help if, you know, somebody shoots you with an arrow, but you have some say in whether you shoot yourself with a second arrow. And so you can do something about it. So that does resonate. I have used it loosely in kind of the work I do, like in terms of, you know, especially early on, I would talk about how, you know, a poor user interface can cause some suffering, right? And so if we want to, you know, so to be compassionate, you want to improve the user interface. And so in that sense, I've used it kind of a little bit loosely, but on a deeper level, absolutely. Like I agree with what you're saying in terms of we're all going to go through stuff and we don't necessarily, it doesn't need to like knock us down and it doesn't need to be immobilizing in that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. So keeping on these three themes of connection, communicating across differences, and assertiveness, it's the assertiveness one that is really calling to me right now that I want to talk about a little bit, because we've actually found this is something we've been coaching our clients on more and more as well, more as more, more and more as well. We've found very similar patterns in that people across all different shapes and sizes and stripes and backgrounds and genders and everything are needing a bit of assertiveness training, and they're asking for it, right? I'm letting people walk over me. I'm just saying yes when maybe I should have said no. How do I say no? How do I stand my ground? Even when it's the littler things, but especially when it's bigger things, like in the face of bullying or harassment or things like that, that assertiveness really plays a huge role, for example. So one of the things that I found to be the most helpful is in, and it's just one piece of it though, but it's what's the difference between assertiveness and aggressiveness? So I'd love to hear your take on how do I be more assertive without being aggressive?
Well, the classic joke is if a man does it, it's assertive. If a woman does it, it's aggressive. But no, but yeah. That's just a joke, though. I'm teasing. Like, I agree with you that this affects people of all stripes and everything. But I still can be amused by that. But yeah, and that's because as a woman, I will say that I did get the feedback that I was abrasive or aggressive, right? People, I think in our last conversation, I mentioned that I spoke up about some issues at my company and where I was the only woman on a 40-person engineering team, and they were afraid of me. And so it's just kind of funny how people can be perceived. So I would say one thing is you do have to sort of, keeping with this sort of Zen thing that we're talking about from the previous question, is sometimes you have to surrender to the idea that you can control how people are going to perceive you. And so as far as aggressive versus assertiveness, it does often depend on things outside your control, how you're perceived, that kind of thing. But that said, how I like to think of it is, I think assertiveness and compassion, they're definitely not mutually exclusive. And so when it comes to being assertive, like you can say no, you can set boundaries with compassion. And I would say that both of those are also ways of being assertive. And so you can be direct, you can still be compassionate. I'm a big fan of nonviolent communication as a tool, and you know, whether or not you follow the formula exactly, I think the concepts from it are really useful, which is where you can communicate your needs directly. And so I think that's how you can be assertive. When it comes to aggressive, I feel like, I guess it's one of those things too, where you know it when you see it, which is why it's so tied to perception, which is why it's hard to pin down. But I think if you're making something personal, that tends to be universally seen as aggressive. So if you're saying, you know, and using kind of judgmental language, where you're passing judgment on whether something is good or bad, right or wrong, versus saying, focusing on, and again, this is from nonviolent communication, but the I, saying, you know, I prefer this, I prefer that, I need this, I need that, versus you are doing it wrong, you are bad at this, you're annoying me, like that, then people are like, oh, that's gonna yeah, be seen as aggressive. And of course, though, there are things that, like when it comes to tone of voice and things like that, that people will perceive as aggressive or assertive, depending on their own biases, their own past experiences, whatever. And some of that you have less control over, but you know, depending on the relationship and the trust and all of that, can kind of modulate that in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Rob?
Well, I want to take it in a slightly different direction.
Okay.
So we deal in people's dream careers and their dream lives. And as an entrepreneur, you're kind of setting your own sail. had we had this conversation not 5 years ago, but 6 years ago, is how much of what you've built since would have been predictable or even understandable as being the dream you wanted to build?
Oh, that's such a creative question. I like it. So, you know, it would have been very hard to predict this particular path. So, but it's when I have heard this thing that you can kind of understand your story in retrospect. So like, as I look back, I can understand how everything came together and all of this. But no, if we spoke 6 years ago, I just would have been, you know, verging on burnout, like not a happy person, not a pleasant person. You probably wouldn't have wanted to talk to me, to be honest. And unless you just, you know, wanted to take pity on me and help me in my little situation at the time.
Be compassionate.
But yeah, no, I think I was lost and, you know, I didn't, I was just so burnt out. When you're so burnt out, it's really hard to make any sort of plan because you can barely like function. And so, no, at that time, I don't think I would have imagined like what has happened. Because I remember mentioning that what I'm about to say in the previous conversation that we had 5 years ago, where like I do take things kind of as they come. Like I've applied kind of the agile principles to how I approach the work that I do. And so I rely on like when I run into people, there's serendipity and it's like, oh yeah, this does sound like an interesting project, you know, or I go and do things I enjoy and then I cross paths with interesting people. And so because of that, there would have been no way really to predict it. So I haven't like set a goal and then been like, here are all the steps and then let me exactly do these steps. And then I reach this goal. It's been more like, oh, who knew I would be doing like a keynote at some conference in Europe? Or who knew that I would like somebody who is writing this like amazing book wants to like feature a story on my company. It's like, or, you know what I mean? Like these opportunities, I don't think I even could have imagined. Like I was just like, oh, I don't want to be miserable in like, you know, these tech companies anymore. And so let me do something to get out of it. And then sort of like evolved from there.
Wonderful. Now, did you have a passion for speaking? I know speaking is one of the more core pillars of how you're driving your business now. Was that something you were excited about and doing some of prior to starting Compassionate Coders?
So that's such a great question. And also, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. And I have a funny answer to it, which is that when I started my company, one of my old coworkers who I'm on friendly terms with, he reached out. He's like, April, I'm so surprised by what you do because you were always so like quiet in meetings. And he's like, the fact that you're like out there on stage, like talking to people, he's like, I didn't even know that this was underneath all of that. And I will say, like, I think that happens to people when they do step into who they are is they stop shrinking. Like clearly I was in environments where I would often shrink or, you know, try to blend in and that kind of thing. Cause I wasn't shining my light. I wasn't fully being who I was. I didn't find my voice, you know, I mean, it's a cliche for a reason, but I hadn't found my voice yet. And, I also have to thank the Blarney Stone over in Ireland because I did kiss that and get the gift of gab around this time as well. So, and they do sanitize it. So even in a post-COVID world, it's still okay to do. But yeah, and so I think I did, that said, I've always, my mom sent me pictures from when I was a little girl and I often had a microphone in my hand just because I do like different little, you know, activities. I was always into karaoke, even like when I was 8 years old, I started doing karaoke. And so I also though, and sometimes that happens, and I'm sure you see this with your clients building their dream careers, is the dream careers often come from that child. Like the things you love doing as a child, you may lose touch with during the unpleasant part of your career, but then if you can get in touch with them again, that's the key, right? So in that sense, I did have a passion for it early on. I just disconnected with it. And then I had to reconnect with it.
Yeah, we absolutely do see that quite often, specifically around the dream. People are very much in touch with their suffering. They're very much in touch with all of the circumstances around them that are not going in the way that they want. But it takes a good deal of prodding to break people out of their shell and imagine a world where that all of that stuff wasn't true and they were able to do whatever it is. Question I often ask people is, if you had $10 million in the bank, everything else was already paid for and taken care of, you've got great investments that are going to keep refilling that, you don't need to worry about overspending it ever, 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 your children's children are taken care of, how do you spend your day once you've done all of the wining and dining and traveling and all of that other stuff? And mostly what comes out of that is something like, I would take on a passion project, and then that allows them to tap into what's really going on. So if you had $10 million in the bank, free and clear, is this what you would still be doing?
Well, that's a good question. Gosh, you're going to cause me to have an existential crisis here. I bet, you know, hopefully you all can coach me through it with your experiences. No, I mean, I was just thinking about it as you were speaking, actually, because sometimes the thing that pops into my head is like, if I could do anything really would be to like have a vegan food truck and like just kind of like do that. And like, just because I don't know, that would be fun. So maybe I do need to pivot. I don't know. Now you got me thinking. But that said, the parts of my work that I do now that I love, like I love doing this. Like I love having conversations. Like, you know, it's Friday, it's a Friday afternoon, evening, whatever. And like getting to talk with interesting people who are passionate about similar things. Like this is a beautiful thing. And like before this, I was having coffee with somebody that also is in the tech space and like, you know, wants to, you know, create awesome things and change things and whatever. And I told her that like we met at like noon and I said, the only thing I have is at 4 and that's, I'm doing a podcast. Other than that, we could just kind of have the day and we could just take it wherever. And so that freedom is definitely something that I've always wanted. And that part is definitely there. I also get to read a lot. And so I get to read books on compassion, on emotional intelligence, on tech, on everything. And I get to read and then process and then write, whether it's actually a blog or whether it's a talk or whether it is. So I get to create. And so those pieces would absolutely be the same. I do think that the pandemic has caused me, part of the reason I joked about the existential crisis is, you know, the in-person stuff is starting to come back. But during those days when there was none of that, especially because I live alone, and so I didn't, you know, it's been tough. And so there was a time where I thought, if it's always going to be virtual, I can't do this anymore because it's not going to fulfill me. And so that's the part where, so I'm sort of in that period where it does seem like it's coming back more where I can do in person. And so I still have hope on that. But hey, the plan B, vegan food truck. So
wonderful. You can do both simultaneously. You can have a vegan food truck and then just somebody else manages it while you're off on a speaking gig.
I like this idea.
So if you imagine a world where, for whatever reason, the virtual remains to be the easiest way to connect with folks, if not the only, but more like the easiest, what would you want to shift? What would you need to shift in order for it to actually work? And I mean, like, really work, not just like, oh, I can do it, but just like be as badass or better than all of the in-person with the travel.
Yeah, who would have thought this would be like a free coaching session? You know, this is amazing. This is why you should hire these people. See how good they are? Like, they're helping me right now, live.
Oh, you can't stop. happens.
Yeah, no, I love it. That's how you know you're doing what you're meant to do right there. But, you know, part of why I'm working on this online course is I do think it could be very rewarding to share what I've been doing with companies to a wider audience, but also not have to be in a bunch of group Zoom calls all the time. And so if people do prefer virtual, I think if I can, you know, record it ahead of time, that kind of thing, and maybe have it accessible and then have one-on-one like follow-ups as needed, that would be good. Because I do find that virtually one-on-one or one-on-two, this is pretty good too, are manageable. Yeah. And I can still kind of see I can use my empathy skills, like in terms of, I can kind of like, although I don't know the special signals that you all may know because you know each other quite well, I, you know, can pick up maybe on some body language, that kind of thing, because I only have two people I'm looking at. But when there's like 12 or even, you know, 20 or like maybe so many that they're off the screen and I can't possibly gauge, that's hard, because as a presenter, as a speaker, I want to be gauging the audience and responding to them. And so I think that if I limit the virtual to where I'm doing like one-on-one kind of thing, follow-ups, I think that is great. And also, I have taken an active role in finding in-person opportunities as soon as I could, like as soon as it was safe to do so and that they were open. I have been out there. And so finding that balance, I think, has been helpful. And so as long as I can have some in-person enough to not feel, you know, to kind of fill my cup with the in-person, then I can do more. I could do, you know, some of the virtual stuff as well and still connect with people.
Wonderful.
Cool. So I have another question that's along the same lines, you know, in terms of, I expect that this will lead to you describing a bit about your career and where you've been. And I know that we talked about that 5 years ago. It's okay if there's a little bit of overlap here, but I want to kind of come into that from maybe a potentially fun perspective, which is a question that I actually ask myself a lot. which is why tech, right? So clearly we have these overlapping interests in the people's side of things, the compassionate side of things, the soft side of things, whatever you want to call it. And we also have overlapping interests in the tech community. And so I'm curious for you, why specifically focus on tech?
That is a fun question. As you said, I do like that. Well, you know, I grew up playing computer games a lot. So I kind of have a little bit of that stereotype there, even though, you know, I may not look like the stereotype that people think of with that. Like I actually was like, I was a like gaming nerd. I mean, that's what I did when I was younger. I think, you know, there, I was dealing with enough kind of stressful things, as, you know, all youths do in one way or another. And I would hide from those a lot of the time on my computer. So I got very into like playing video games and living in these virtual worlds kind of early on. So then when I was able to build those and learn to code, I was like, oh, this is wonderful. I can build these worlds, all of that. And so I think that that's why that sparked my initial interest, was this ability to create. It almost felt like, you know, well, it is learning new languages, but it really felt like this just completely new tool to like create. And that was amazing. And so that's initially attracted me to it. And I still, like I said, really enjoy the innovation and just, again, how tech really can help solve many problems. Like it's not the solution. And I know people tend to sometimes give it too much, power and think that, oh, it can solve all our problems. No, that's not true. But it has like improved things in the world. I mean, the technologies that we have, like the fact that we could communicate at all during the pandemic across, you know, in different continents. I mean, that's thanks to technology, you know, I mean, technology is wonderful in that way. And just, I think that optimism that has to be part of technology, that we, you know, to dream bigger and to think bigger and to think outside the box and all of that, love that. And then the only thing is reining it in a bit with the people stuff, because again, any extreme is going to take you too far. And if you're all in on the tech thing and optimization and all of that, I think then you're like, oh, well, people are very inefficient and, you know, they're the problem. So let's kind of optimize out the people. And then we'll, you know, and so I think that balance. And then I will say too, on a personal note, like my, you know, my parents, like one was kind of more focused on science and that kind of thing. And the other was more artistically focused and, you know, creativity and all of that. And so I think that somehow too, you know, I'm like a mash of that. And so I think that as far as how you talked about like these, why both, it's yeah, because like I am both. And I think I won't be totally content if I'm only doing one.
Love it. Love it. So would you consider what you're doing now to be your dream career?
Oh, that's the tough question. For now, it is. And I think, let's say, how about this? Before the pandemic, I would have answered that in a heartbeat. Yes. I would have been like, yes, I am on top of the world. It's amazing. As soon as like early 2020, it was like, oh, this is, the, I found it. I don't know how to pronounce it, but the ikigai, do you know what I'm talking about? Like the overlapping like Venn diagram. It's like, it's this Japanese concept of like, and in the suite. Okay. So it's like what you're good at, I don't know how to pronounce it right, but it's like what you're good at, what you, people will pay you for, and something, you know, something else. And
love.
It's like what
like
you love.
Passion.
And then the sweet spot's in the center.
Yeah.
And so before the pandemic, compassionate coding absolutely was in the center. And I was like, all right, I found it. Like I said, that the challenges there really have caused me to question it. So it's hard to answer that question with a complete yes, because I think I'm in that liminal stage. I'm in the in between where I'm, you know, not sure. I'm going to continue doing this in some capacity. That's for sure. But the exact nature of it, it is ever evolving.
Oh, that's so honest. I love it. I love your honesty here. And we ask pretty much every guest that question for obvious reasons.
Yes.
Yeah, I just really love the honesty there, because that's part of our message, is that your dream career is your dream career until it's not. And then how do I figure out what's next? And just it speaks to the ever-changing, ever-evolving nature of life. And it's a huge part of our life. So yeah, I love that perspective. I know it's going to resonate with lots of people.
Yay.
As you look at your career evolving, your dream evolving, and then your career moving to match that, what would be some of the things that you would want to have as part of that future dream?
That's a good question. I think I think more connection with people kind of in a longer term. So I've had repeat clients where I do talks with them, and then I do a training with them, I do follow-ups, and then I maybe do another training with them and that sort of thing. So I've had some longish term relationships with companies and that sort of thing. But a lot of the stuff that I do, like I used to often speak about how it's like planting seeds of compassion. And so many times the direct results take a while to like grow. And so, you know, you plant these seeds, and then sometimes, like you, just the other day, someone was tweeting about a talk that I did in 2018, actually. And it was like, you know, oh, this inspired me and did it. I was like, oh, that's great. You know, and who would have, like, if I would have given that talk and then expected all of the result then, I would have been disappointed, right? And so that's why I always saw it as planting seeds, because this is like a long game. And so I think, you know, some form of more connection, like I've thought about adding on more of a community element in terms of especially online, given, you know, the way things are. But, you know, there's all these things about community management is such a difficult thing, as we're seeing the social media companies all try wrestling with it right now. And there's no easy answers. And I will say that very much so, because having known people trying to work on this, and you might think from outside that like, oh, you just do this, and then it's, you know, or you just follow these rules, and then that's fine. No, there's no easy answer there. But anyway, so yeah, I think that a way of having community might help, because that way I'd be in more consistent contact with people. I've started that to some degree through restarting a newsletter that I connect with people over, and people respond back. And so I'll write like a long newsletter, they'll write back a long note, and I'll read it. Like I read those because I love hearing from people. And, you know, I see this feedback online. I've seen people like tweet about like, you know, your email shouldn't be longer than XYZ, whatever, which I understand. It's trying to optimize, try to be efficient, but I love long emails. So I may regret saying this too much, but I really, but for now, bring it on. I love reading them.
Can you see yourself evolving your organization so that your community is a tribe of like-minded people that give talks and trainings and wherever they're local to?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting idea. Like almost where it's like a train the trainer kind of thing. And then I have like maybe a, you know, yeah, I have, people have asked about that before. I was very like against it, because I would say, well, I like to bring so much of my personal story into it that it would be weird to have people saying the same stuff that I'm saying, but they don't have the experiences like that I went through or anything. And so sometimes maybe, but I do question myself, like maybe that was more ego driven. And I was like, oh, I need to be the one. And I don't know, I'm just admitting it could be partly that, who knows, like all of our subconscious motivations. But I think that that is a possibility. I'm more open to it now, I think, because scaling this out, I think, is important. And like, I love the connections I've been able to make and like resonating with people in person and, you know, one-on-one, and just seeing the, like seeing people make changes has been so powerful, and just on teams and all of that. But I do think you can reach a wider audience, of course, if you have more people doing it, and people, and also I think it would serve people well, because people would love to have, you know, little local meetup groups that they could go to and, you know, talk about. I mean, if I wrote a book on compassionate coding, which I originally intended to do, and then, you know, things happen.
As they do.
And actually, to be honest, I might write one day, but I'm glad I didn't write one before the pandemic, because I think I've matured a bit in terms of my approach to all these issues. And I know this is always probably the case, but I think I would have cringed if I had written one before, just because I've evolved, and I know we all have. And but the, you know, something like a pandemic, it's just, I don't know, that's like life altering. But anyway, all that to say, if I wrote a book, it would, people could have little book clubs and that kind of thing. So that's also been something I've thought about.
That's cool. I have a question that just popped in that's a little bit separate, but certainly related to what we've been talking about. I'm imagining people listening and what questions they might have. It may sound like a silly question, but I know that you will have a great answer to it. How can coding be compassionate? So in other words, if we were to look at the actual act of coding, of writing out the syntax, right? Let's focus on that, right? Maybe not necessarily the people aspect of it, but how do we make the actual act of coding and the letters on the screen compatible? Mm-hmm.
So I'll answer that in a few ways. The first is that no matter any situation, the one human you can't remove from it is the one writing the code, right? So like, even if they literally are just writing it, so like that person's always going to be involved. But that said, as far as your actual question about the words on the screen, I think you know, in terms of like how we choose variable names. So like how we, what we choose to name things and label things in the code has an impact on how much it could be understood by people who read it in the future. And so if you apply empathy while you're coding, you can choose the words you type that will help, that will like help other people understand what you're trying to communicate. So if you choose like not very descriptive names, if you're reading that in the future, if other people are reading it, it's not going to be very compassionate. The other thing is that the code is producing something, and you know, an app, whatever, a website, you're building something, and thinking about the choices that you're making while you're writing that code clearly is going to have an impact and can cause or alleviate suffering in people. And so I think you can't have compassion without people. And so there's, at some point there has to be people, but as far as like the human in front of the screen writing the code, it's also self-compassion in terms of like, I used to mentally beat myself up a lot while I was coding because I would be like, oh, I'm such an idiot. And like, I can't figure this out. Like, and I would use really negative self-talk. And so I think that plays into two, like when we're actually in the act, the what's running in our heads. But so I mentioned variable naming, also just like how we structure the code, like how we structure, how we build APIs that may be consumed by other people. All of the code is going to be touched by someone, even if it's just our future selves. And so designing all of that with compassion in mind can be really helpful. And then there's little things like, well, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to go down too far down with that. But anyway, and how we choose to name things and trying to increase the number of people who'll be able to understand it and who, I mean, sure, won't be too offended by it. So if you, I guess that's where I wanted to avoid, but I'll go there anyway. Like if you use, like, if you named every variable like expletives as the far extreme without, like, that's going to maybe bother people. So I think in that way too, you know, if the code's going to be read by anyone, then compassion can definitely be applied.
Yeah. Self-deprecating humor is profuse in method names and in Git commits. And then we had a wonderful series of changeovers as people renamed the primary branch of their code base to either be primary or main or something more neutral than what it was prior. But then, yeah, the self-deprecating cringy humor that runs amok within dev teams, because when your stuff doesn't compile or it doesn't work the way you expect, you do take it personally. When you're working with an organization, how much of that intersocial stuff has to come to the fore and be dealt with?
Yeah, so it definitely varies on a case-by-case basis, because as you mentioned, some of like self-deprecating humor can be healthy. You know, it's like it helps us process situations, and you know, especially on a team where it's part of the culture and people understand the humor and people don't use it against others, but it really is just a healthy kind of jokey kind of culture. I think that sometimes it's fine. You know, I think it's more about communicating within the team what is appropriate and that kind of thing without, so sometimes, and that can vary from team to team. So I think that there's not a universal blueprint that people can use in terms of, you know, here's how the language norms you need to stick to, because it's just going to depend. And of course, then when you bring in a new person, it's important to incorporate that into the culture. So if the new person, like, to be honest, like this did happen at a lot of companies where if it was mostly a culture where it was like all men, then there are certain like in jokes they could make because they are a certain in group and they could make some jokes and people, you know, maybe weren't offended or whatever. It was just a cultural thing. And then like, oftentimes, you know, then you do bring in the first person, the first woman, whatever. And, you know, not even that she would necessarily be offended, but just the fact that you're bringing in someone who's not part of the same subculture, you're not part of the exact same like in-group that you had before, then yeah, maybe, you know, certain things you need to change. And so I think that that's kind of the tension that we work with when we're dealing with teams, is just that there's always going to be, we do have sort of a culture, but then we also want to be able to grow and adapt that culture so that it's not, so that we can be more flexible, and so that we're not keeping people out for the wrong reasons and that kind of thing. So I think that some of the language can be funny and jokey, and it's fine. It's not hurting anyone and people like it. When it starts to cause a problem and when not everybody's on board and that kind of thing, that's when it becomes an issue that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, and that can get pretty thorny, right? I can imagine a situation where you have this, you know, culture that's been built over the course of years and years and years, and then someone comes in or multiple people come in and it and they voice, perhaps, let's say assertively even, mm-hmm. right? Saying, I really don't appreciate the way that we're communicating. Can we find another way? Mm-hmm. Then the people who have been doing this for a while, how are they going to react? Well, they're going to react how they're going to react. And some people might be fine with it. Oh yeah, you know, that's cool. But some people may get very defensive about it. I can imagine that happening. And it just speaks to this. I love the idea that you can't really detach the human, the people from the coding, because there's a human who's doing the coding, and then there are multiple humans. And then there's multiple humans on the other side of receiving whatever the product of that is. And just like with writing, like writing a book, writing a song, writing a poem, when that person is approaching it from an empowering place, the most empowering place possible, then that code, that syntax, those words, that music is going to be even more, it's going to be better in just so many different ways. So how much of what you do is focused on like the coding aspect of it, like, you know, the variable names and how it's structured versus the people aspects, right? The communication, the assertiveness, the, you know, working through challenges and differences kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to tease apart, to be honest. Like, it really is hard for me because I think that they overlap so much. So like a lot of times people, like past clients have sent me like the pull request code review kind of like exchange. And so we have this like conversation where people are communicating, but we're talking about very technical concepts as we might call them. And, you know, they're just telling like, oh, should we use this? Should we name it this? Should we name it that? Like there's this debate, but yeah, like I'm picking apart too, not only like, you know, they may, because here's an interesting thing is sometimes when people are super assertive, maybe even aggressive in their communication, it's because they care so much about the technical side. Like they know if we go with this approach, it's going to save us in the long run. It's going to be good for us. It's going to be the compassionate thing in the long run. And so they care so much about that they lose sight sometimes of how they're communicating, because it's like, I care so much about this that I'm not able to communicate necessarily. I'm not able to stay calm because I care so much. I'm so invested. And so it's hard to tease apart how much it's because they're so overlapping that it's very rare that I can say like, oh, this is just a people thing. Cause sometimes when there's tensions between people, it's because of something that happened in the code. And so, and then when there's tensions between people too, it also affects, you know, yeah, how they code and that kind of thing. So yeah, so that's my non-answer to that question.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I'm glad I asked and I loved it. I love it. Rob?
Yeah, it's interesting because this has been a topic in multiple of Jen and I's coaching over the past week and a half even. Citizenship behaviors and the expansion of citizenship behaviors as you go up a career, I'm going to use the word ladder, but we know it's not really a straight line process, are really, really vital. In my personal definition of what a senior software engineer is, a senior program manager, a senior product manager, et cetera, these people are going to spend a significant portion of their time building a better culture for the people who are, for lack of a better term, behind them on that ladder. Where are you seeing that interplay between seniority and longevity, probably even with the company, and the ability to bring in positive, compassionate citizenship behaviors into their everyday interactions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that as you grow in, like, as you accumulate more power in the organization through becoming more senior in whatever way, you are able to introduce these concepts more and people listen to you more. So you have a little bit more freedom, and also just people already kind of trust you. And so you've already like built up your reputation. And so you may be in a position to bring in these thoughts. However, there's some interesting research that like, as you become more powerful and that kind of thing in different contexts, you can become less empathetic, believe it or not, because sometimes like you know, if you lose touch with what it was like being, you know, not the person with the most power in the organization. And so because of that, there's an interesting thing that sometimes the people who can make the most difference are not as motivated to make that difference, which leads to junior people who come in, maybe the first hire who's trying to like advocate for something, and they're not in the best position to do it, to be honest, because they don't have a lot of sway in the organization. But what they do have is a fresh perspective. And so I think that the answer here is to help like at both levels, right? And so a lot of times when I'm communicating, whether it's something I'm publishing online or whatever, I am aiming for the people who are already established in the organization, because I've built up the reputation having been in tech and being in leadership positions that I can kind of leverage that a bit to connect with them. And then they can help, they can to try to convince them, and then they can help you know, people earlier on and help establish these things. I do still have some, you know, communication with people earlier on, but the messaging is different because people earlier on, it's more about like what power they do have, because you always have your personal power. Like I have to remind myself that, I like to remind other people that no matter what situation you're in, and we touched on this a bit in terms of suffering versus pain and that kind of thing, but no matter what situation you're in, you have a choice. You have some choice in that matter, right? And I mean, even Viktor Frankl in like Man's Search for Meaning, you know, talks about this, like we have an ability to respond to what's going on, even the most horrific things, but definitely in terms of what happens at software engineering companies. And so because of that, when I'm speaking with people who are earlier on, more junior, that kind of thing, I don't always say, okay, well, here's how you change everything in the company in the first week that you join, because that's just, it's setting you up for failure and it's just going to feel disempowering. However, you can plant seeds too. You know, there's always, and I will say this too, is that there's always, you know, you talked about this ladder. If we continue with that, there's always people lower down on the ladder than you. And so no matter where you are in your career, even if you literally are just learning to code, there are maybe kids who have not, don't even know what coding is. And so maybe, you know, you can volunteer with children and help increase, you know, availability of these skills and accessibility of them to different groups. And so there's always going to be somebody. And like how you said, it's not actually lower, it's not actually higher. It's just more people maybe earlier on in their path, whatever it may be, on a different path, it's like in a, whatever. But the point is, we all have different ways of contributing. And so, yeah, I think if you approach it from different levels, you have a good chance of making a difference somehow.
Yeah.
I have a sense. So I'm taking it as a given because it's my expectation and my experience that being compassionate in all of your communications, being empathetic to others, building as big a tent as you can of the people that you have is the best way to go forward for teams of all sizes, shapes, structures, regardless of what you're trying to accomplish. That is an assumption and an assertion I'm willing to make no matter where I go. For others who are not quite there, can you talk for a moment, April, about what's on the other side of doing the sometimes challenging work of shifting your language, shifting your culture, and shifting your focus to be more empathetic and compassionate, and shifting an organization on that?
Yeah, so I'll answer that with somebody. So I feel like I also have always kind of felt it to some degree that of course we want to like, you know, do this. And so it's hard for me to answer in that sense, but the answer I'll provide comes from a conversation I had the other night with somebody who is very established at his company. It's a he's been in the industry a very long time and he's very high up at the company. And he said that when he first started getting trainings on any kind of communication thing, whatever it may be, that he rolled his eyes and he thought, you know, like, why do I need to do this? This is not, you know, of course I know how to like talk to people. Of course I know how to be a good person and all of that. And that's often the first response. And
I'm guilty of that myself.
Yeah, I think, you know, there probably was like some time when I was as well, like early, like I think so. But and so he shared that he's like, but, you know, he's like, I realize that if we really want to sell this product to a lot of different types of people, if we really, you know, want to make connections with different things, he's like, you know, there's something to this. And, you know, and he was, you could tell that like, he didn't know quite how to articulate it yet, but that even still he, and the reason he even was saying this was a younger person that is still in college was sharing how he's like, you know, I don't get the point of all this stuff because, you know, we already know this stuff. We know how to talk. And so because he had this like older person, like kind of sharing, it was kind of a nice exchange because you could see that somebody had taken a, you know, a little while to like warm up to this, but that what he saw was the benefits. And then he said, yeah, he's like, now we have, you know, salespeople, like in his, he was talking about technical sales. And he was saying, now we have salespeople who can connect with all sorts of people. And we have, you know, we're able to like make better product choices as well, because we have this like different perspectives. And so there is a lot of research to support the idea that people with different perspectives can come together and, you know, create better products. That's true. Of course, it always feels weird to have to make, like, as you said, you take it as a given that compassion is good. It is weird to have to make an argument that like sort of the business case for being like, you know, a decent person. Sometimes it's like, really? But I mean, that's the society we live in. So you meet people where they are, right? So like, that's how I've kind of made peace with it, is I'm happy to you know, to make that case, because there is a case, but I would still want to do it if there wasn't. But I do think it's important to make the case. And I'll also say, though, I mean, something that skeptics will bring up, and so I'm happy to bring it up, is that there is a point at which, if you have people who just don't agree on anything in any way, they are not going to necessarily come together and be a great team, and they're not going to build a good product. And so, like with anything in life, the extremes are also, you know, can cause problems. And so even if you, so yes, of course, there has to be some common elements that bring people together. And so when we talk about finding ways to be compassionate, and I will also say this, even just with compassion in general, you can be compassionate towards somebody, but choose not to interact with them in your life at all. Like you can, you know, you don't, so that's the other thing, is like, as far as like building a bigger tent, like sometimes that tent is just sort of maybe who you are compassionate towards, but like you still have like a cordoned off part of the tent that are actually the people that you interact with on a daily basis, or the people that are currently in your life. You could still be, have some sense of compassion for the others, but they don't necessarily have to be, your coworkers or whatever. So that's kind of where the nuance comes in. But yeah.
Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, Coverage Cat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the People Stack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at Coverage Cat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, Coverage Cat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal Tech Leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be, so we love how Coverage Cat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form, and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com. This is somewhat related to this sense of selling it. It actually, selling compassion, selling the soft side. It reminds me of being in grad school, and we would have arguments about like job performance versus job satisfaction. So for those listeners who don't know, I have a PhD in IO psychology. And so my expertise is in the science of organizations. And so for some people, it was like, it's all about performance. It all has to get tied back to performance. And performance is actually the ultimate outcome, the ultimate indicator. But then there were those of us, including myself, who said, well, hang on a second, isn't job satisfaction? And rolled into that are things like compassion and also things like enjoying your work, feeling engaged in your work, all of that. Like, isn't that important in and of itself? And so we would go back and forth on it and have some fun conversations. And so it's so interesting that you bring that up. And yet there is still a case to be made for being compassionate at work and for the human side of things. So I'm wondering, because I know that a large part of our audience are technical leaders who are in positions to make this change happen, or at least to inspire this change to happen. So what words, based on your expertise, what might you share with them, with technical leaders, if they wanted to make their help inspire a workplace culture that's more compassionate and more connected?
So is this to people who are already kind of on board, or people who are like,
let's say
still...
they're already on board. But if you want to do both, that's cool too. I'd imagine a lot of our audience is already on board with this.
Yeah, thing. I guess so. You know, given the work that you do, you probably don't have a lot of people hate listening, or whatever they would call it these days. I think that, Yeah, I mean, where to begin? Where to begin? So the leader is in this great position where, like I said, because they've built up kind of the bank of like reputation, and they have like this experience, and they have they're able to like make these conversations that I think, to bring more compassion, it's to, even if you can't remember what it was like just to like be curious and talk to people about like what their experience is. And so, you know, compassion in a lot of ways is often just involves active listening, which, you know, you two are very good at with your active listening and follow-up questions, but that's a big piece of it. So like, I mean, the easy way for leaders to get started with this is just, you know, being open-minded and listening to people and understanding that people are coming in with different values and people are coming in with different experiences. And I think one shift we've seen in the industry is that where there was kind of more of a monoculture in a lot of companies where it all, you know, what looks like a software engineer, like what their interests are and whatever looked a certain way. Like now we're seeing like people have different interests and can be software engineers, and people have more balanced lives and they may, you know, be interested in nature and going outside and exercising, but also interested in coding sometimes, and they want to balance, and they're not just the one like stereotype of what an engineer is. And so I think that's an example of where questioning some of our assumptions. And so I think leaders, while they have great experience, sometimes they can get stuck in their ways just because they've been doing it for so long and think, well, this is just how you hire, and this is just what makes a good engineer. And I think some humility on their part is one of the biggest pieces to unlocking compassion. Another thing is like what's rewarded in the company. So if the company, as you talked about with performance, so if the company only rewards like whatever measure of performance they have, hopefully it's not this, but like lines of code or something, like let's just say it's some sort of metric. That's not good to just reward like some individual metric, because if you are, then you're leaving out people who spend some of their time mentoring, right? You're not rewarding that sort of compassionate behavior of mentoring, of helping the group thrive, not just the individual. And so since leaders have that position of power, one thing they can do is just alter what they reward in the organization. And so those are a couple of examples of where they can put this into practice, using the power that they have, and remembering that they also still have weaknesses, and they may be different weaknesses from when they were earlier in their career.
Perfect. I love it. Rob?
One of my early frustrations, so Jen and I have been together since 1998, and I'll leave everybody else to do their own damn math. When Jen was going through grad school, she and I were together. So I was reading over her shoulder while she was learning about all of what the literature said about high performing teams, good citizenship behaviors, and all of the psychology around having good management and a good organization. I was meanwhile then also a junior, mid, and then senior software engineer, seeing absolutely not that, and being so frustrated with the delta between what the research has emphatically shown for 100 plus years and what actual practices were and what people were talking about as practices. And I note that as we've been talking today, institutes and organizations and research groups have been mentioned. What is your relationship to the cutting edge of the research, how the research is happening, and what's the delta you see as you're going through your days and your steps?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And it's been an active year for my involvement kind of in the research side of things, because I was definitely started off just, you know, my relationship to research was I would do research and then I would like, you know, implement it and apply like what I had learned through being in the industry. And I guess I was kind of trying to close that delta a bit and like try to help. But like this year in particular, I've had a lot of contact with people in the research community. So I was at an ACM conference in Australia that was for software engineering. And so it's an academic conference. And so, you know, there's a lot of theoretical stuff, and it was great because like I am not currently in academia. And so it was nice to be involved in that conversation because I could provide practical, insights from my day-to-day work. And then I could learn from them what they are learning through the research that they're doing. And to be honest, like one thing that's been amazing over since we last spoke was just that there's been so much more research. So like, I feel like when I was first coming up with talks, I was trying to scrape together what I could about software engineering, like teams and their success in terms of research. There wasn't like a lot. There was some, of course, and but it's just, it was hard to find, and it wasn't like always, it didn't always apply. And, but since then it's like, it's, you know, it's expanded so much. I mean, I was just reading a paper on developer thriving. So that's a keyword people can look for, developer thriving. And there's so much research now on that in terms of how that will like, how, and again, it helps look at like, you know, not just individual success, but kind of like team success and sense of belonging and all of these wonderful things. And so I see, because, you know, tech has kind of matured a bit as an industry, we're starting to realize that we're not so special and that we don't get to like, just do things our own way and, and neglect.
We're special.
Yeah. We get to like just neglect like all, you know, organizational and management like research for years. I mean, sure, it's great to innovate, but like some things, like there's a reason they've been around for as long as you said, is like some things actually do work. And, you know, I think it's a little bit of the hubris that like we thought like, oh yeah, we could just like throw the book out. It's like, okay, no, there's some, you know, there's some reasons that we have like that, you know, these things can work and some things don't work. And it's good to challenge those too. And tech has been, you know, good in that way too. Like some, like, you know, agile, kind of like applying that across like different industries, I feel like, you know, outside of tech even has been in some ways, you know, a benefit. I mean, again, nothing's perfect and whatever, but like, I think that good things can come from tech. I think people not having to wear suits all the time is probably a nice thing that tech helped normalize. But that said, people are on the other side of that too. And they're like, oh, no, we should, you know, go back to like, you know, dressing up or whatever. But so there's always going to be people with multiple perspectives. But yeah, but I do think the delta is closing in both directions. Like I think we're applying research. And then I also think researchers are having a closer relationship with companies.
If someone were to want to have their company be more influential or at least more helpful in bringing more of that practical to the academic, do you have avenues that you can suggest for them to get involved in or to who to reach out to?
Yes. I mean, I don't think, I didn't realize this, but like researchers are eager to connect with people in the industry. And and this is something
turns out they're people too.
Imagine that. And like, I didn't realize the extent of it, but then I was like, as I got involved in some of these like organizations, I was like, we're trying to make our stuff, you know, apply more in the industry and like, but we're, you know, what's going on in the industry and all this. And especially because in some ways, like I said, the virtual world like connected people, but it also kind of stopped some of those hallway conversations that used to happen at events where some of this like, you know, stuff would be shared. And so I think too, there's just a sense of like, what's even going on out there and like, you know, across different, you know, fields or whatever. And so I'd say if people want to get involved, like you, it probably will not be hard to find a researcher that wants to talk to you about, you know, this. And so like I'm actually working on a collaboration with a researcher that's involved in like emotions and in the like encoding and all of that. And, you know, so I may have a very close relationship in the sense of some of her research may become things that I implement in my compassionate coding work. And so I think that like the way to do that is to like do some, you know, good old research online. I feel like we're using the word research so much, it's losing meaning, but like do some searching online for the keywords that you're interested in. And you'll find that in the academic, this is one tip for people who are far removed from academia, is they often use fancy words for simple things. And so, you know, yeah, which, you know, it's nice, but like sometimes when they like, yeah, they're just that they use like longer words than maybe you may be used to, but they still may be talking about just like pull requests, and they may just be talking about like, you know, variable names or something. But so you may have to do some decoding on that. But there's probably some like human factors is a phrase that's good to look at in terms of, you know, software development, if you're interested in the human side of things, because they will, that's a word that is often shows up there category. And I will say when I brought that up, it's just like a casual tech meetup. They're like, what does that even mean? What are you talking about? I thought, oh, you know, I work on human factors and da da. And then she's like, what is that? Like, and so I think that, yeah. So that said, it may be a little tricky, but you can do it. I believe in you, the people, awesome. The listeners.
Awesome. Yeah. So I want to change gears a little, but yeah. Okay, cool. Also human factors. Yeah. Totally terrible name. Terrible name. Cause that was part of my training, was training in human factors psychology. At that time it was more around like, like the design of things and the design of systems and seeing systems as an open loop. But I can totally see how I've been a little bit detached from the academic world because you kind of have to be to run a business. So learning how the language of marketing. But yeah, human factors is a great keyword there. And yeah, researchers are people too, connect with them. So yeah, let's change gears here. And actually it might not be too much if you feel like it, but it's actually not. I want to talk a little bit about mindfulness and spirituality.
Let's do it. Because
one of the things that we've found, these have always been fascinations of mine. And I started out like dipping my toe in it. And then I find that the more that I share with clients and with our audience about mindfulness, and even straight on spirituality, right? So mindfulness is that nice sort of, there's science and then there's spirituality. And then there's like, what's the middle part of that, right? That sort of is the bridge. It could be mindfulness because there's tons of research on mindfulness. And you can talk about mindfulness without hopping on the woo-woo train at all. But I love hopping on the woo-woo train. And I find when I do that, our clients absolutely love it. Like 90% of them. Some of them are just like, no, that's not for me. And that's fine. And that's cool. But I'm wondering what your experience has been, if you've had similar experiences in talking about these kinds of things, and if you've been finding it to resonate with people.
Yeah, well, and so because I'm like 7 years into my business now, like I'm going to be less, scared about talking about this than I would have been maybe when I first started, because I didn't want to alienate people by diving in and bringing it in. But of course, like compassion does have that, association. I mean, one of the books that I read that really resonated with me and has been hugely influential in my work was 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life by Karen Armstrong. And she's, of course, like a religious studies person, right? And so her book is a lot about how all like kind of moral philosophies and religions of all types, like seriously every single type, that at their core, they're about compassion. And so, and again, though, that includes moral philosophy. So even that is like not just about, religions and that kind of thing. But that said, it's funny. So just last night, I was at an event for women entrepreneurs. And because of the area that I live in, this is a very, like, I live by the beach. It's got that beachy vibe. There's a lot of woo. There's a lot of woo-woo. It's a woo-woo place. And I, at one of the meetups, somebody was talking about, past lives and what she learned from her past lives. And somebody was talking about, like, last night they were talking about astrology. And I'm like, oh my gosh, if my tech friends were in this, they would be like, they couldn't sit through it. They couldn't sit, they would rage quit the meetup. But I thought, I honestly like love sitting in on all of this. Like I can absorb, and I'm not saying like, oh, I just like, agree with everything and like sign on to I'm part of every religion and every spiritual whatever. No, but like I also think that just as a society, we've been so, especially like lately in terms of the scheme of like humanity, we've been so focused on like just the rational side and all of that and like just the cold kind of clinical analytical stuff. And I think part of maybe why your clients are open to, I would venture, is partly because of this hunger for something spiritual, like even if it's not, and I think that can have a broad meaning. And so it doesn't, I think even like the atheists, even people who have really strong like anti opinions on that, are open to something bigger. And I think too, of some sense, like, even if it is just a bigger, some of the unknowns about how the universe works or that kind of thing. And so anyway, so in my work, to answer you more specifically, like I have shied away from the woo-woo train a bit, in the sense of I was talking more about the science, because I was like, partly because I used to be really skeptical. Like I used to make fun of some of my friends and stuff for like, their woo-woo stuff. I would say like, I really would make fun of them. And so I'm going to own that, because I did. And I'm much less likely to now. Now I'm like, I can appreciate stuff sometimes in a metaphorical sense. I can appreciate it in a, well, who knows, maybe sense. I can appreciate it just in a, wow, like I'm going through a really tough situation. I'm willing to try anything. It's like, I think for all those reasons, I am definitely, I'm not surprised that it's resonating with people. And I also, but so I'm more open to it. I definitely, I was on a call earlier this morning with a woman who was, quote, we were talking about tech stuff, whatever. And she quoted Rumi. And I was like, that's exactly like, let's get spiritual. Let's like talk about, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's part of an interesting shift too. I don't know if you're familiar with a Wisdom 2.0 conference in, it's like this, it's basically kind of like a tech and woo kind of thing. It's like, they've been having, they have conferences and about spirituality and the intersection with tech. And so I do think that there's like the growing openness to that. And I will say it's partly because of podcasts. I think a lot of podcasts are covering this territory. Well, not a lot, but like more are. And so I think it's opening people's minds. Plus going through a tough time sure makes people like open-minded about stuff sometimes, like open-minded solutions, that is, or something to keep going, some sense of hope.
Absolutely. And I would share that I was the same way with our business, that I didn't touch it with a 10-foot pole in the very beginning, because I thought that it would just, that people would rage quit, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever the equivalent would be in our business. And then I just started doing a little bit more and a little bit more. And yeah, people love that stuff. Our people do. I think part of it too is because both I converted Rob over to the Woo Woo Choo Choo.
Nice. That's I think a success it's story.
Because like we're passionate about it. And they feel that passion. So I think that's part of it too. Like just, hey, this is what we want to do and this is what we want to talk about. So yeah, it's really exciting.
I was a reluctant, slow convert, but once I got on board, I became the conductor of the Woo Woo Choo Choo very, very quickly.
I love that.
And then that allowed us to take our life from a smaller apartment in the outskirts of Boston, where I was working day in and day out, just like anybody else in tech, and pushed the business to new heights, move to Maui, and do so while still owning a Porsche. I mean, you can't say it doesn't work anymore, mm-hmm. and you can't say that doing things without it does.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
a really
I was a reluctant convert, but there is absolutely a place for it. And we've been talking a lot lately about how, you know, because it is starting to get more traction, it's starting to get more visibility, and it's easy to knock on it because the experience that people have of it are the book The Secret, talking about law of attraction, or Stuart Smalley skits from SNL, talking to yourself in the mirror with daily affirmations. Or the Gwyneth Paltrow stuff with her company, and that makes it easy to dismiss. But that's not what it is we're actually talking about. It's not what we're actually doing. What we're doing is aligning more of our focus, more of our intention, and more of our everyday actions toward what we actually really want. And even just getting engineers to talk about what they really want without bringing in all of the scope of everybody else around them and bringing it, you know, the thing that you do on a project where you have to keep sizing things down until it fits in the sprint. You got to stop doing that with your own hopes and dreams and desires and wants and start going actually after the things that you want full-heartedly. And I say full-heartedly, not full-headedly, because I am now conductor of the Woo Woo Choo Choo, and it's all steam ahead.
I love that. I hope you can convert more engineers to that side as well. I do think get them on board that train, because I really do think it's like when people can touch into that heart space and whatever that means. I mean, like that's the energy we need. Like that's the energy the world needs, is like people who have the head talents and have that kind of thing, like bringing in more of their heart to what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
When
go ahead,
you, when you think about bringing, so I want to keep going on that because sure, woo-woo choo-choo away. Here we go. Making stops in Chattanooga. So where do you see the biggest gap between the heart that needs to be brought and the heart that exists when you're having your interactions with different organizations?
You know, since we're going on the Woo Woo train, I will say I heard Marianne Williamson talking about how, like, on a societal level, how the problem is not really most like individuals. Like, there's not like a problem where people are just bad people. Like, we don't have like a world that's mostly full of bad people or anything like that. It's the structures that are set up. And like a lot of those are remnants of, you know, a society where maybe you know, it did pay to be like more of a quote unquote bad person or whatever, where people took advantage of certain situations, et cetera. And so I think that's true on an organizational level in the sense of a lot of times, like a company can be full of good people, like honestly, good people with good hearts, but where, you know, they're following a pattern that they saw from the past and it doesn't really work. And so, you know, and so even a company full of good people can have really bad outcomes and can be really unhappy, and people cannot be feeling good and they can't, you know, and so I think, you know, and Jen can probably speak to this, having a background in all of the organizational stuff. But I think that's kind of a lot of times what I work on is helping the company, helping companies adjust their structures and adjust like their just kind of the shared vocabulary, just all that kind of thing to be, you know, to come from more of a place of like rewarding the things that, like I said, like in the past about like how earlier in terms of rewarding mentoring, rewarding some of those things are ways to do it. But you kind of, if you have like a rubric that you follow for performance reviews, that's like left over and it's like, doesn't take account to those things, then, you know, you're stuck in like this, you're stuck in your ways there. And so I think some of it's stuff like that, just like these remnants, like, just does this serve us anymore? Does this work? And like, is this working? And I think that a lot of it comes down to that, on the organizational level, I think.
So archaic power dynamics, and how much would you also attribute to toxic masculinity? And I mean, actually toxic masculinity, not like just every holding a door open for somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So toxic masculinity. So I'm like, I feel like that's a phrase that I've tried to retire using, although I understand it, like, because I think it's misunderstood, but I think that I think, just so I will say right off the bat, that it's not that masculinity is toxic. It's that there are elements of masculinity that can be taken to a toxic extent. And similarly, there are elements of femininity that can be taken to a toxic extent. So I do like to clarify that, just because that's absolutely something that I've noted. Like, there are definitely groups where, you know, it's like femininity taken to the extreme, like, can lead to like sort of this gossipiness and whatever and kind of thing. And I mean, that's not an untrue thing. Like, there is some truth to that. Anyway, so that to say, like, I think that I actually have, you know, the legacy systems do set up this pressure. And so sometimes that does drive some of these behaviors that we often like group together as toxic masculinity. But since we've already like, you know, cracked the like the woo-woo thing here, I will say that like, I really do see like the evolution of tech is kind of more balancing the masculine and feminine to some degree, like, but not men and women, but just the energies of masculine and feminine, which can show up in, you know, all configurations, but that it's been so heavily masculine, even if a lot of that was good masculine too, not just the toxic side, but, you know, and then we need more of that feminine. And so clearly compassion, although it is not by any means limited to women or feminine people, it has been seen as sort of a more feminine trait. And so I don't always get into this. In fact, I'm not sure if I've ever said this publicly, but here we go. I do see like the work I do is trying to help balance that out. And so that's why I've evolved my approach, because I feel like I was the first one, like maybe when I first started, to be like mansplaining this and toxic, you know, and patriarchy that and whatever, which, you know, maybe there's still a place for, but I think I'm at the point now in the conversation where I'm like, oh, like men are suffering a lot too. And that, you know, if we do try to like go too far on the compassion side too, we're going to create other problems. And we're already, the pendulum is going to swing way, like it's, you know, I do see problems there. So yeah, so I think there's an element to that, but I think it's more about finding balance rather than trying to replace one thing with another.
Wonderful. I'm going to define at least masculine energy as being the focus on logic, on structure, on rules, on hierarchy, and on trying to cram things into something that approaches predictability. How would you define the feminine energies, or even counter that definition?
Yeah, no, I think that I agree with that definition. And I'd add on one that I've heard too, is like kind of short-term thinking has also been lumped in that, like trying to win in the short term. And I think, you know, the balance of that, the feminine side, I think we do bring in more of that nurturing. We do bring in more of that long-term thinking. And we do bring, you know, in more of that kind of collaborative energy. It's just, you know, it's funny because like some of the stereotypes that like used to like kind of anger people and still can, it's like there's some truth to it. It's just more about how we approach it with nuance and like not trying to put people in boxes or say everyone's this way or everyone's that way, but kind of more understanding these kind of energies that we're talking about rather than individuals. But anyway, So yeah, I think that it's, you know, in some ways it's almost like, okay, everything you said, but the opposite, but it's also more, but we don't, and that's why it's not about like switching it over. It's about coming to the balance, and it doesn't necessarily mean 50-50 split in everything. It just means finding that balance. And so, yeah.
And that's part of what makes it a little more woo, is because it's not something that you can just say it needs to be this percentage of this and that percentage of that. It's going to ebb and flow in both directions. When it's truly in balance, it's going to move back and forth between the two. I have found the most success of my career is bringing more of those feminine energies to the teams that I work with, because they have an overabundance of structure and overabundance of rules and hierarchy, and god-awful overabundance of focusing on logic, which is, I could do a whole nother podcast on logic. I'm not going to get into it now, but I don't. Yeah. As we move forward into a more balanced space, what would be the dream? What would be the pristine nirvana that you would love to bring to fruition?
That's an interesting thing. Like, I wonder if that desire to kind of achieve some, you know, like utopia kind of state is also like, you know, kind of a trait in one direction or the other, you know what I mean? In the sense of like, I don't think we'll ever get to that like perfect nirvana. I'm not sure. I don't think that like, I'm not
How about
sure
a perfect
that
Pearl Jam.
Yeah. Hey, I love it. I definitely appreciate that. But yeah, no, I think that's a tough question to answer. It's similar to what we talked about earlier, actually, is like, if you asked me like 6 years ago, I'd be like, okay, April, what's your ideal career? Come on, just tell me what you want. And then like, we'll do it. We'll make it happen. It's not like, okay, so what does the industry look like? What does the world look like? Let's just figure it out. And then we'll just manifest it. We'll manifest it. And I think it's one of those things where I wish it were that easy, but then I kind of don't, because then life would be kind of more boring if we just could like all have a big worldwide meeting and say, okay, let's do a retrospective and what's going well and what we want to go differently. And then let's, you know, let's change it. But I think any efforts to talk about this stuff and bring it more into balance. And I think conversations where we do kind of balance both sides are useful. Like this one, like this is a helpful thing to have, because I think people can listen to this. Like I would feel comfortable sharing this even with people who, you know, like, I mean, you, like, as you talked about, your listeners are probably already going to be open to some of these things. But like, I would even be comfortable sharing this with people who have very different views from me, because I feel like we've done a nice job in this conversation of kind of, what do they call it? Like sometimes steel manning the other side, sort of like kind of representing the other side with that, like not straw man, it's not straw manning, basically, is that I think we've acknowledged that there aren't easy answers here. And so I think this is like a microcosm is kind of what I'd hope to see more of in society and in tech. Like during the pandemic, like some tech people came out with really strong opinions this way or that way. And then it's like, okay, now you're in this box or now you're in that box. And either, you know, we don't want to talk to you. And, you know, this group doesn't want to talk to you. And now this group will only talk to people who think this way, and all these divisions. And it's just, to be honest, like on an energetic level, it was just, it's like, this is not helping. Like, and so I think these conversations where we can kind of disagree, but still respect and still show that kind of thing, I think that this is a good example of what I'd like to see more of.
Wonderful.
100%. 100%.
I think the fact is that there is more in common, of course, than there is not common. And even with the pandemic, that I was listening to a podcast. It was interviewing the authors of a book called Random Acts of Medicine. And one of the statistics that they found was that when you polled the CDC, 90% of Americans got at least one dose of the vaccine, which shocks the hell out of everybody, because the narrative that we hear is that it's so polarizing and that you've got this side who are pro-vaccine and this side. But end of the day, most people got some of it, at least. And we do have to remember that there is a far more similarity, far more in common, we're more often than not on the same side, trying to accomplish the same things. And it's nuance at the end of the day of how we go about it.
Absolutely.
100%. So what I also wanted to add to this masculinity and femininity conversation was when Rob said, you know, you said for you, it was bringing more of the feminine energy. Me too. And I am, you know, and this just shows that this is not dependent on, you know, the sex assigned at birth or your gender identity, right? This, that there are men who would say, I want you connect more with my masculine. And an example of a woman of, I want to connect even more with my feminine. And doing that has just opened up a whole new world of possibilities and fun and just joy, really. I know that word is thrown around, but I've experienced pure joy from that. And I think another thing that came to mind as we were defining the two, and I love your definition of masculine energies and feminine energies, and it's particularly on the feminine side, intuition, tapping into intuition. So that's definitely one thing that we work with our clients on about a lot. And so what's interesting here, just to shed some light on the magic, if you want to call it that, or at least the transformation that's available, is so what I've found so many times is when we're talking to a client and we get them to tap into their intuition, like they come to us with a problem. Oh man, how do I solve this problem? There's this person who's leading this project and they're doing it all wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do I approach it? The way that we approach, so the one way to approach it is to say, well, here's what the science says. Here's the best practices. Here's the strategies. But the way that we tend to approach it is, all right, I get it. So compassion, right? I get it. I understand and really like affirming and connecting with them. I totally get it. I totally appreciate that. And depending on who the client is, there might be some work before this question, but it's basically, what does your intuition tell you? What does your inner badass tell you? And 9 times out of 10, if they're really connected to their inner badass, they will give the answer. They say, oh, I think maybe I should have a conversation with this person where we define the boundaries of this relationship. Spot on. Guess what? That's what the research says. That's what we found to work. Trust your intuition even more. And I think that this overlaps with one of the big three that you mentioned in the beginning. So the connection, communication across differences, and assertiveness. Communication across differences. How do we communicate across differences? We use our intuition, right? What does that mean? Well, that can take a lifetime of work to really trust your intuition. But what I've found is that when you can inspire people to connect to their inner badass, to connect with their divine within, to connect with infinite intelligence, to connect with their intuition, whatever language you use, we actually already know how to communicate, even in these tricky kinds of situations when there's extreme differences. So in terms of communication across differences, is this resonating with you? Do you use any of these kinds of approaches? And what have you found to work the best, April?
Well, it really resonated with me, yes, because there was a time during the pandemic where, like, I was assumed, like, before the pandemic, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm learning about compassion. Like, I'm sharing this. Like, I feel like I was really feeling in touch with my intuition. I felt like I could approach even really difficult subjects and I would bring heart to it. And I felt like I never felt scared. I was kind of just like, no, we're going to do this. Like, I can talk about anything with anyone. Like, I was open to it. And then a lot of stuff happened during the pandemic. And I got this email from on someone's newsletter and they're like, here's how to talk to like your friends about X or something. And it had like these templates for how to talk to your friends to be sensitive about certain issues. And I was like, oh, I guess I should be doing it this way. And so then like a friend had brought up the issue and I sent them an email and I used this sort of template thing and tried to follow these rules that I thought, oh, I must be doing it wrong. I need to do these rules. And I sent the most awkward email. And it was like, you could tell that the person who received it was like, April, why are you talking about it in this weird, like stilted way? And I feel like so when I didn't listen to my intuition, when I was like, oh, maybe my intuition's wrong. Maybe I should be, you know, following this pattern. And do I have it all wrong? And so that's why it resonates so much. Cause I was like one time I remember when I didn't, I was just like, it was so embarrassing. Thankfully, you know, I recovered the friendship, but I was like, I'm sorry. I got this email and it told me to do this thing and I tried anyway. But that to say, like when that's, you know, it's funny because when you said that, like until you explained it, I was like, oh, interesting. The communication across differences, intuition. And then once you expanded, I was like, oh yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. I would say I'm not sure that a lot of the companies and people I speak with are quite there yet at the in being in touch with intuition. And so I can't necessarily start from that point always. But so sometimes I do start with templates and whatnot is kind of just to try to help, because I think depending on where you are in your journey, like sometimes that can be really helpful. Like nonviolent communication is basically a template for how to communicate. And you can just follow that and it does help. And, but then as you, again, get more familiar with techniques and things and practice and your inner, you know, voice and everything, your inner mentor, like inner guidance, I think that you don't necessarily need to rely on certain templates and that. Anyway, so I do a mix of both. I think it's about, you know, with this classic thing of meeting people where they are. Like, you know, if I'm, some people are just like, please just give me some sentence stems I can use and then complete. And I'm happy to start with that. And, you know, let's do that. And then let's talk about how, as we practice, we don't necessarily have to follow the formula exactly every time.
Yeah, we absolutely do that too, right? I think you said it earlier, you got to meet them where they're at. Right. So we definitely use like Mad Lib style kinds of things, fill in blank, insert your own stuff here, kind of a thing. Because it's like, okay, where do I even start? Right. Okay, let's start there. Oh, you mean this is the right way? You mean I've been doing it right all along and all I need is a tiny little bit of calibration, tiny bit of cleaning it up. Oh, okay, cool. And then along the way, there's this parallel path, parallel journey. Is that what your intuition said? Is that what your inner voice said? Is that what your wise self said? Yeah, actually. Okay. So then that's correct. That really is wise. So it really is fun to see people shine in that way and to inspire people to do it. So it's awesome. It's awesome what you're doing.
Likewise. you too.
Yeah. The feeling is mutual. I can feel that for sure. So we talked about a whole bunch of cool stuff. I don't have any other questions written down. Do you have anything, Rob?
Yes. If an organization or an individual wants to become more compassionate in how they go about solving people's problems through code, how do they get in touch with you, April?
So my website is compassionatecoding.com and I have a contact form and that newsletter that I alluded to. And, you know, like I said, some resources there. And I, you know, social media is ever changing. So depending on when this even comes out, it's like, who knows what social networks will even exist anymore or what they'll be called.
But even in a few weeks, who knows?
In a few weeks, it's like, what are they gonna be called? Yeah, exactly. So who knows? But usually I go by April Wenzel online, or so if you look that up, you'll find my latest things, and the website will stick around for a while. So and I, you know, like I said, I accept long emails. So if you want to send me a long email, it's april@compassionatecoding.com.
Wonderful. And do you have any speaking coming up that people can see you at?
I will be in Santa Clara in October for the LLVM user group meeting. And that's one that's open to the public, you know, in terms of everyone can register. And yeah, I'm speaking at some schools as well coming up. And so, you know, those people are less likely probably to just drop in. But, you know, and I don't have any currently like virtual conference speaking engagements, and that's intentional. So sorry about that for people. But yeah, hopefully I'll be getting back out there and circulating a bit more and meeting people in person, and making actual eye contact instead of staring at a webcam. Like I'm doing right now.
Well, this has been such a fun conversation, multi-layered conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. I've really loved it. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Thank you, April.
And that wraps up another episode of the People Stack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero, and it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.